Dale and I were really involved in some conversation at the table, and one of the children was sitting in a high chair, and apparently at the first time, tipped off a glass onto the floor. Well, we all stopped, picked things up, rushed around, and made sure he was all wiped off. A couple of days later, in the course of a conversation, I saw that same child push that glass off. I got up and wiped up everything and so forth, gave the child a good amount of attention, some of it negative at that point. But he needed some attention, some stroking. And there is a phrase that if you don't get positive strokes, you will take negative strokes. Or?
You know, having halitosis is better than no breath at all.
That does explain a little bit of why some people always seem to have problems. Some children are always into trouble. Some children, you know, have learned very early to get a lot of attention doing negative things and getting negative response. And as they grow older, some people see themselves as always trying, but somehow they always fail. And when they fail, somebody's there to rescue them. We talked a little bit about that yesterday in terms of the alcoholic. You know, tries and tries, but fails, and somebody comes along and rescues, and then they get themselves, they need a little bit more attention. All, you know, at a very deep psychological point, deep within themselves, and certainly not conscious. But again, to go on and on until someone will rescue them, which is some very real attention for them.
A couple things in this and to underline. One is that to a great extent we choose to feel what we feel rather than the world making us feel it. And that's often very hard to hear because we often think the world makes us feel. Now, the negative feeling we choose is often related to the way we got our negative stroking as a child. So the reason the person driving up here wants to feel guilty, because that feels like home. That felt like it felt when I was in relation to Mama, because she was always telling me that I would never get any place on time and I should feel bad about that, and I, da-da-da-da-da-da. So it's often related to the way we felt when we were getting attention, and we continue then to look for reasons to feel that. In transactional analysis language, it's called a racket. It's in a sense, not a real feeling, in that it doesn't naturally grow out. It is a feeling that we almost turn on at times to feel. And then this second part that Ricky has been talking about, that often we want our problems. That the very things we don't think we want, we often want because they get us negative stroking. And so that may change the way we deal and approach our problems. When we begin to say, hey, maybe my problem is doing something for me. Maybe it's meeting some kind of a need. And I can take a look at that, and when I discover what that's about, then it may be a lot easier to try to get rid of it, rather than continuing to fool myself to think that I totally don't want the problem. Because then I keep sabotaging all the solutions. Well, I tried this and it didn't work. I tried this and it didn't work. And repeatedly we sabotage whatever solution we try because deep down we still want the problem.
Sure, do we even have enough time to do this?
No, maybe it's not.
Do this? We've got this whole thing loaded, and I want to make sure that we have time to do the things at least reasonably well that we're presenting to you.
Yeah, let's. Let's deal briefly with the brown stamps and gold stamps and how they work. One of the useful tools that Eric Byrne came up with. He had a way of watching human behavior and then putting it in a language in a way that can be used. And one of the ways, you've probably heard about it, is brown stamps and gold stamps. He says that there's an economy of feelings and an economy of recognition. Now what happens is that often when someone says to you, gee, you're stupid, they're offering you a brown stamp. They're offering you a reason to feel negatively. But you can at that point choose whether you want to receive it or not. So, I say, gee, you're stupid. You can say,
oh, well, gee, you must be right. Yeah, that was a pretty stupid thing to do.
Okay. Or I can say, oh, gee, you're dumb.
Thanks for your perception.
Okay. You can choose to accept it and feel bad, or choose to turn it down.
Or choose to fit it in a wide spectrum. Hey, that's one person that thinks I'm stupid. Now, I live with him. It's important to me what he thinks. But if on the wide spectrum, I feel that what I have done is not stupid and that most people don't receive it that way, thanks for your perception.
Gee, I sure like that outfit that you've got on.
Oh, this old thing. I ran into Penny's just before we got on, before we left Wenatchee, and just grabbed it off the rack. That's literally true.
Gee, I like that outfit you've got on.
Oh, thanks. I really like the colors myself.
Is it a Jacques Penny special?
Yes.
Okay, we can choose also to accept gold stamps or to turn them down. Now what happens is that we often are taught to accept the brown stamps and turn down the gold stamps. And so many people say, well, I just can't accept a compliment because it isn't all absolutely right. All I said was I liked it. She can yet discount it. Well, it isn't good enough. Now, one, you can be aware that we do that and begin to accept the gold stamps, and it doesn't mean you have to be perfect. If someone likes what you did, say, okay, I'm glad you liked it. But we accept the brown stamps, and what we often do is put them in a book. Now, Eric Burns said, it's like green stamps, like trading stamps. You do something, and you get a stamp, and you put it in your book. You paste it in your book. He says, what people do is save up their brown stamps. And, goofed the dinner the other night, and you were late when we were trying to get to this appointment, and you told me that I was too loud at the meeting or something, and you didn't like the way I did this. I can take all kinds of brown stamps and feel bad and save them up and then use them to justify something. Well, boy, I'm going to do what I want to do on Saturday rather than what you want to do. Or sometimes more serious than that, I'm going on a spending spree or a lost weekend or a free blow-up. You've done this and this and this, now I can let you have it. Or a free divorce, free suicide.
Here we get people coming in for counseling who appear in their verbs, their words, to want some help. And then during the course, maybe the week between one session to another, she did such and such. And he put it in his book, slammed the book, and said, I'm through. I've done it. I've done all I can, and that's it. And really, to a certain extent, was just waiting for that last slip so he could fill the last page and say, I'm out. That really does happen, and very dramatically that way.
So we're often taught that the negative justifies something. If so much has been done to us, then we can justify doing something. And we hang on to the past in order to do that. So you might ask yourself, what kinds of stamps are you saving?
Always at this point, When Dale would give various presentations, I would be sitting in the back room going like this, don't forget my favorite, which is brown-edged gold stamps. How many of you, in terms of your own home, in dealing with your children, or perhaps in remembering what your parents have said to you, remember the comment, oh, you did a good job cleaning this room, but remember to get underneath these tables. So while mother intends to give a good, you know, good approval, the last thing kind of puts the brown edge on it that makes you feel like, goofed again, didn't quite make it. Or, thanks for watering the lawn, but you forgot the flower bed. Or, we mentioned the term yesterday, gee, A's in five subjects, how come you didn't get it in algebra? If there's always that little brown edge, almost as though we are afraid to let somebody know that we think well of them, that it might not motivate them to do better. None of us are perfect. But, you know, if you give that little brown edge, there's kind of a sense, well, then you won't get too big a head about it.
So it's called a yes, but. Mm-hmm. And the but turns the yes into a no. And so the end feeling when you're yes, butted, is to not feel good about what you did. So separate the two. Susie, I like the way you got out and cleaned your room this morning. And then when you ask Susie to clean her room next time, hey, Susie, hey, would you get under your bed this time? There is a place for that, but when you attach it to the compliment, you negate the compliment. And Susie ends up feeling, oh, I blew it again. You know, mother will never be, it'll never be enough. And there's always a way, you know, there's always something we can butt on whatever's done. It's never perfect. So to notice what gets us to do that, do we really fear that if we gave a good, clean compliment that our child wouldn't be motivated to do a good job again? I think that's the fear that lies behind it. If I really said I liked it, they might get lazy. Whereas usually it's just the opposite. Think of yourself. If someone really says you did something neat, man, you feel like doing it again. Whereas if they said, that wasn't so hot, sometimes you want to do it better, but you're not too sure about the motivation. So actually, it's the opposite of what we think and what we fear. Okay. Some of what this is about is that things that happen in the present hook our past experiences. That, as I mentioned earlier, the memories of the past, everything that happened in the past, is recorded in our head, our thinking, our feeling, and in our body. And present things happen that helps us, causes us, in a sense, or hooks us into reacting. And
that's a good word, react. We are acting again the way we have done it one at a previous time.
One time I did an exercise where we were going to do this and there isn't time. I just want to tell you about it because I think you'll recognize it. Sometimes it's neat to see it happen. But I have people call a person by the name that they were called as a child and called in a variety of ways. So I did this in one workshop. And two gals sat down, and one called the other one's name and said, Susie! And the other gal went, literally jumped. Her whole system was so frightened by that, the way that name was called, the way what it must have meant to have one of her parents call her, that her whole system jumped. And so a lot of what's recorded in us gets hooked into the present, and we react out of that. Awareness then is beginning to separate what is it coming out of the past that's affecting the way I'm reacting to what's going on now. Let's do some more exploring. What is it that you might have grown up with fearing that it might happen. Doesn't have to be a real big thing, but something that you were kind of anxious about or afraid of, whatever, something that might happen to you or with you. Can you think of some kind of thing that you were anxious about or fearsome of? Okay. Now I'd like to have you turn to one partner, facing one partner, and decide, do that, and then I'll give you the next instruction. Okay, be quiet, please, and let me give you the instruction. Okay, one of you decide to be it. Raise your hand. Who's going to be first? Okay. Now, I'd like to, let's see, could two of you pair off there? There's a couple of extras.
We've got a, yeah.
And really need to do this with just two so that it's a process. Okay. Is there another single? Okay, there you go.
There's a single here.
Another single? Okay, would you like to pair up? Okay, you who indicated that you're first, would you share what it is that you fear? And then you who are the listener, just look at them and ask this question, and if that happened, what then? And then you give an answer, whatever comes to your mind, and after they're done with that answer, say, and if that happened, what then? And get an answer, and then again, and if that happened, what then? And if that happened, what then? Okay, do you understand the process? Okay, start by giving your fear, and then the other person respond with, and if that happened, what then? Okay, I'd like to have you switch. And don't converse. Don't converse. Just do that. Just have one person say what the fear is, and if that happened, what then? And just stay with that process until you're completed. Don't talk about it in a conversational way. Okay? Okay, are you finished? Okay. Now let yourself be aware of what happened as you did this, as you began to peel off your fears. Because what often happens, one of the things that we do with people as they deal with fears is we begin to raise the question, what is the worst thing that could happen? If that happened, what then? And as people really begin to tune into that, they discover that they could handle the consequences, that it's not as bad, and yet we often grow with the fear of the consequences, and that fear is related to a much earlier experience. So take a look at your fears and go towards them rather than what we often do is go away. We pull back from them. We kind of not let ourselves understand them. We have all kinds of rationale why they are the way they are. We have all kinds of rationale that support our fears, and yet often don't take a good look at them and say, well, what if, you know, if it happened, what, so what? So if someone decided not to like me, does that mean the end of the world? Wow, it might. Really? Well, no. Mean you could live through it? Yeah. Oh. Yeah, I could. Huh. I guess if someone rejected me, that wouldn't be so bad. That's their choice, and that doesn't make me a lousy, no good nobody. And so we begin to discover some freedom of moving in areas that we often limit ourselves. Now, our fears often then get in the way of our senses, that we don't let ourselves see or hear sometimes people are afraid and try to see everything. Sometimes they're afraid and they don't want to see anything. And the same is true of our ears. And I think our other senses in some ways, especially touch. Some people are able to let themselves feel and work with their touch, and others don't. So let's explore these sensing capacities, just in a brief way, taking a look into each of them. Ricky?
Jane Swihart, who was in here a little earlier, told me a story. She has done a tremendous amount of traveling around the world. She told me a story about a pygmy tribe in Africa that she visited, or that she knew of, where the hunters would go out to hunt into the jungle, and all the people in the village would go on about their work. And several days later, and it would be at varying times, all the people, without any noted signal that they were aware of, or that she was aware of, all the people put down their tools, go wait by a certain entrance into the jungle or path into the jungle, line up, and the hunters would walk right back in with all their game, and they'd be ready to clean the game and get it prepared. And the question was, how did you know the hunters were coming? I said, we heard them. And so, of course. When the pygmies talk about some people who go and live with the whites or go and live in a city or white outpost, they say that they lose their hearing. They are no longer so acute. We limit our hearing very much. So what I'd like to have you do right now is to close your eyes and to listen and be aware of what you hear and how much you can hear. And when you're ready, will you open your eyes and share briefly with one person near you what you could hear, how near, how far, what kinds of things you could hear.
We often are very sight-oriented culture, and because of the tremendous amount of sound that we have, I'm sure we learn to shut down our listening or our sensitivity to sound just for our own protection, and so often we block our capacity for hearing just for that reason.
Did anyone else hear the music over in the
village? Yeah. Yeah.
From over there.
Mm-hmm.
We were saying
over there.
Yeah.
Huh.
Great.
So we can explore those capacities. One of the ways that I became aware of the problem of listening was in learning about active listening. Some of you may have taken parent effectiveness training. If you haven't, I would highly recommend that to you, to learn something about the skill of active listening. And when I say something, I think there's a long process in learning how to fully active listen.
There's also a teacher effectiveness training that uses the same material in dealing with the teacher in classrooms and so forth.
And some of what I discovered was that when I thought I was sitting listening to a person, I was spending a great deal of my energy and focus on thinking about what I was going to say, so that I really only heard maybe 30-40% kind of in a skimming way of what the other person was saying, was not really getting into, feeling with, understanding, being with another person. And what I've discovered and sense is that there's probably no greater way to love another person than to listen totally to that person. And so when a person comes to you with an issue or a concern, to not try to solve it for them, to not try to judge things, to not try to enter into it in any way, but say that my major purpose right now is to hear what this person is saying and for me to try to understand it, not to do anything with it. And so just feeding back, a paraphrase is one way of saying, hey, what I hear you're saying is this, am I really catching what you're saying? And they say, no, that's not quite it, it's this. And, oh, it sounds like this, is that what you're meaning to communicate? Well, yeah, that's pretty close to it. And just listening, just saying, and letting them go on. If there's a pause in their comments, to let there be a pause rather than jumping in with something to say. And in order to do that, you need to come to a conviction that the most important thing you're doing at that moment is listening. Because we often think that there's so many other things that we ought to be doing right then. Helping them figure it out, giving them ideas, solving it for them, or correcting them in what they think, telling them how it's right, so forth. So, again, we don't have time to go into this. At this point, what I would like to suggest is if there is a significant person in your life that you want a different relationship with, a better relationship, a spouse or a child, that you even structure it where you sit down and say, hey, I'd like to try this exercise. For 5 minutes, I would like to have you talk about anything that you would like to talk about, and I will just listen. And I will just listen. And that doesn't mean sitting, saying nothing, just like this. It means constantly letting them know what it is you're hearing, staying with them, letting them know you understand, showing by your posture and your face and so forth that you're actively listening to them. I've done this with a lot of couples, and they say it's one of the most powerful things that they've ever done in terms of affecting their relationship. And they do it several times a week. Just taking that time, and it doesn't take long. 5-10 minutes each can have a real impact. And one of the hard things is those moments of silence. In other words, part of the instruction is the person says whatever they want to say, or they can be quiet. So some people have said, well, we started doing the exercise and my husband sat for 3 minutes and didn't say a word. It's okay. And then when he said something, you were ready to listen. If the person was able to stay quiet that long. Now, what that's about is we've got this tremendous agenda going on in us that affects the way we listen and the way we look, and to be aware of that in many ways so it doesn't get in the way. So much for the auditory or our listening capacity. I'd like to move now for a few minutes to our kinesthetic or our sense of touch, being in touch, and to do it in a little different way. Where are we time-wise? Yeah. Okay. I'd like to have you close your eyes. Ha-ha.
Something new.
We do this to help focus attention, because then we don't have so many senses going that we have to deal with. You can let yourself breathe. Let go. And sense within you now a rhythm. Each person has an inner beat that's going. Okay, now I'd like to have you raise a hand and just begin to, in the air without making a sound, begin to tap with your hand or move your hand in a way that expresses a beat that you feel that is in you, that expresses what's going on in you at this point. Okay, just let your hand begin to express a beat. Keep your eyes closed. Stay in touch with your own beat.
maybe a couple of different beats in different parts of you. See if you can incorporate them. Continue with your eyes closed. Okay, softly now begin to clap the beat. Listen to your own beat. Okay, let your beat grow louder and begin to relate your beat to other beats around you. Okay, and then begin to let yourself become a part of the group. Okay. Let your beat go. Turn to your group of four and share whatever it was you became aware of as you did this. Okay, we're going to want to try to wrap things up. I know you're stopped in the middle, but we'd like to have just a couple minutes to put some things together. So we'll interrupt you and you can share later.
One of the anthropologists who has been writing a lot now about things that are beyond culture, Edward Hall, he's the man who wrote the book called The Hidden Dimension that was fairly popular a few years ago, did some studies with a beat within people, a rhythm that they came in touch with. And some of his students took movies of a playground of children someplace in the United States, and then, as good students, they went back and ran it over and over, frame by frame, and became aware of two things: that there was a beat that was going on for that whole playground, and there was one child who covered more of the playground. We actually got in touch with the whole playground. And so they kind of, I'm not sure it was facetiously, said it was almost as though she were the conductor, making sure the whole orchestra stayed in time. They contacted somebody that somebody knew who was very much into rock and roll music, who knew a great deal about that kind of music, and he was easily able to find a melody, a song, that they could play that stayed in sync with the action on the playground for the whole 7 minutes of the excerpt. It was that steady a beat. They were in sync, really.
So you might have discovered sometimes when you get with a person and you just can't seem to get in sync, there's just another beat going and you don't quite know what it is.
They also photographed people who took movies of people who were in sync, in the sense that they really seemed to be able to respond to one another. Frame by frame, their eyelashes blinked at the same time.
Yes.
Even now, they've done studies before. Same way, they get into rhythm with it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot going on besides the actual touching, that we are in touch with each other in many ways that we're not aware of, and are communicating on a subliminal level, our beat, even as we may have discovered a beginning to an emerging beat for the group here, and yet able to maintain some individuality. Okay, there's some new things being done. Ricky, would you tell briefly what Bambler and Grinder are doing?
Again, people who are using some film clips, some videotapes, and so to take a closer look at how people react and interreact. And they were also doing not only videotapes, but audio tapes. And their conclusion, which they have used quite successfully now for a number of years in terms of the therapy and the groups that they have dealt with, is that people receive the world. They take in what's happening out there. We've got all of our senses available to us, but we often find one that's our favorite. Dale mentioned we are a very visual society. We are inclined to use our eyes a great deal and kind of downplay our hearing or our kinesthetic or our feeling. That came home to me last week. I was talking to Jim Burtnesser. He was giving a talk in here, and Jim's a very visual person. And he was talking about watch your language. Not listen, but watch your language. And that's the other thing they discovered, is that if a person is visual, they have a tendency to use visual words as they talk about things. Do you see what I mean? Now, if you look at it this way, or, you know, I have a tendency to take the long view. If a person is primarily auditory, and I think there were that probably, you know, in more base cultures, oral tradition cultures, or perhaps before TV here, they have a tendency to use words that have sound in it. Now, if you listen to what I say, or I hear what you're saying.
That sounds good to me.
Or perhaps with somebody who is very kinesthetic, that feels kind of awkward. Or I don't like the feeling about that. Problems come when you have a husband who is very visual, who sees things this way, and wives, or can reverse the roles, who feel differently about it. And when they try to talk about the same subject, they to an outsider, it sounds like they're talking about the same thing, but they do not feel or see that they are understood. And so one of the ways that these particular psychotherapists use is to help them translate from one to the other, and once they are aware of it, they can often do that kind of translating themselves.
So you might want to raise the question, do I orient the way I perceive the world visually, auditorily, or kinesthetically? And usually we have a primary way of putting the world together in our heads, and it usually comes more through one of the senses than the others. And then it'll affect your whole language, the way you think, the way you approach things, and also your ability to be understood.
Maybe that, you know, because we do use so much more of sight these days, maybe that's why preaching isn't as effective as it used to be, or so they tell me.
So on this note, we'd like to end. Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. Let all men know your forbearance. The Lord is at hand. Have no anxiety about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which passes all understanding, will keep your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. To discover how to be alive to the world is to discover how to receive all things, how to receive all things with thanksgiving, and to discover then a peace that passes all understanding. Thank you.